We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AA Blue Chip Speakers.org, desperately in need. We'll hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them, too. I must have this thing. I'm very grateful to Tim to allow me to do this because it lets me get to introduce Charlie W. We're home group members at it's a place called the Heavy Hitters. And we're known for our being very, you know, soft and kind and respectful. Not that so much. But we made a pledge right before the meeting to try and keep this fact based and respect the house. So Charlie turned me on to a sponsee, and I've seen him at other meetings and other 12-step fellowships. And although I have more time than he does, he has quality recovery. You're in for a treat.
Hey, everybody. My name's Charlie Wolf. I'm an alcoholic. And what a treat it is to be here tonight. Good to see some faces I hadn't seen in a while. Tim, thank you for the work that you do in keeping this thing going. I appreciate it. I know there's a lot of other people that appreciate it. And a special thank you to my sponsor for yet again volunteering me to do something. Thank you, Terry. I'm from North Carolina. Born in North Carolina, and my mother's family were a really hard-working group of people. They didn't make a lot of money, though, and my mom really wanted to get out of that type of lifestyle. She was attracted to my father because he came from a long line of money. He had a lot of money. My grandfather, my great-grandfather had a lot of money, and she liked that. She liked the ability to do what she wanted to do. What my mother didn't realize was that that money, that family money, had come from, you know, had been passed on through generations of selling illegal liquor, prostitution, extortion, loan sharking. My great-grandfather was in and out of federal prison several times throughout his life. The reason that I always start my story off like that is that my father was killed when I was a year old. And the very first memories that I have of being a child were of being scared to death. Because when my dad died, my mom moved in with my grandmother. And I remember when I would go outside to play, like most kids do, that I wasn't allowed to go very far. Because my grandfather basically had people that followed us everywhere that we went. I remember seeing the cars sitting up on the end of the block at my grandmother's. And so I remember being very scared and very uncomfortable at a very early age. My mom got married about 2 years after that. And her idea was to get married and to move away and get as far away as she could from my father's family. And that's what she did. We moved, you know, she married a good guy, someone who I didn't have a great relationship with. I felt like I was just kind of baggage from the marriage, that he married my mom and really only dealt with me because he had to. You know, I grew up in a middle-class family. We moved a lot. We moved like every 2 or 3 years. So my whole deal was that every time I would get somewhere and I would feel like I was beginning to get settled and I was making some friends and I was beginning to feel comfortable, the carpet was pulled out from underneath me. And we moved to some strange places, you know, maybe not strange to you, but for a kid from North Carolina, I did not like Michigan. I'm not a fan of Detroit, Michigan, you know. Sorry. it was weird, you know. Basically my entire childhood, we'd move every 2 or 3 years, and I never felt like I could get grounded. We finally moved to Atlanta in 1982, and I've been here ever since then. I was doing great in school. I did well in school. I had a good relationship with my mom. I did not have a relationship with my stepdad. I never had someone that was a good role model for me as a man when I was a kid. When I got here in 82, I started playing sports. I'd been a little short, fat kid, and I finally hit a growing spurt about 6th, 7th grade and shot up and, you know, turned into this good-looking person you're looking at today. That was a joke. That's a joke. First lie. That's right. Long story short, I hit a growing spurt, you know, and I started playing sports. I started playing football, and I finally felt like I had arrived. I felt like I had some friends. We didn't move anywhere. I was doing well in school. Things, for the most part, were going good, you know. I enjoyed playing sports. Started playing football when I was in like fourth grade, and that progressed through high school. In high school, I didn't have the big white light drinking experience like a lot of people do. I simply just started drinking on Friday nights after football games. That was it. It wasn't a big deal. I mean, I got drunk, but I don't ever remember it being this big, huge experience. I do remember that I was still very unhappy. You know, I didn't feel good about myself. And almost in a sick way, through playing sports, I enjoyed hurting other people. I liked playing football because it allowed me to take out some of that anger and that pain that I was carrying with me and legally inflict that on other people. Told you guys that I had, I started to make some friends. I had three other guys, and we went everywhere together. We went to spring break together. We went to prom to get together as a group with the girls, not with the guys. And everything seemed like it was coming along well. My junior year of high school, two of my best friends had left to go home after a football game. And on their way home, they wrecked their car, hit a pine tree, and killed them both instantly. I really started drinking a lot during that time. And within almost a month, the last remaining member of our crew had been drinking and flipped his car, and his girlfriend was pinned in the car, and she was killed. And so there was a lot of trauma that hit me all at the same time. I don't really remember exactly the specifics on things that happened, but basically I quit going to school. I just stopped going to school. I started drinking. I had gone down to the rocks up on the Chattahoochee, up in Sandy Springs, where you can climb out on the rocks out there in the middle of the river. And I met this guy who was, he was instantly my role model. He was the guy that I wanted to spend my time with. He was that father figure that I've been looking for. He was not a good role model either. Within just a few weeks, I was working for him and driving from Newport News, Virginia, to Miami, back and forth several times a week. The life that he was living was basically strip clubs at night, drinking, other things. And we had plenty of money. We had nice cars. He let me drive all his cars. Man, I felt I'd made it. You know, I felt like I was like living a movie star life or something. You know, you got all the hot looking ladies and cars and money and all you could drink. And had gone to a meeting, my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, about that same time. My mom had came and talked to me and begged me to go to a meeting. I was only 17 years old. And they put me in a little treatment program at Ridgeview. I stayed there for maybe almost a month. and I decided that Alcoholics Anonymous was not for me. I decided I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in these rooms drinking coffee with a bunch of old people. Had a much different view at 17. And so I left. I ended up in prison less than 2 years later in Alto, Georgia. And at the time, Alto is Lee Arendelle Prison. If you don't know, it's a women's prison now. It was one of the most violent prisons in the state of Georgia, and one of the most violent prisons in the country. And I thought I was really a bad dude when I went in there, you know. And that experience in that place left a lasting impression on me. I really felt like I was fighting for my life every day. Thank God I was a big guy and I knew how to scrap. But it was just it was an ugly picture that I got from that place. I remembered when I turned 19 that they transferred me to Jackson to go through classification and diagnostics as an adult. Man, I was happy to be there. I was so happy that I'd made it to that place. And I took a job because I wanted to get out of the dormitory, and my job was working in the store. And so we filled all the store orders. It was pretty simple. But on Tuesday and Thursday nights, I packed up these two little wheeled pull carts to take down the store orders to the guys that were on death row. And I remember going down there, and I remember looking at these guys, sitting face to face with them, handing them their stuff, and just thinking to myself that this was not the life that I wanted to live. I knew I had to make some big changes. I got out of prison in 91. I didn't drink again until 2000. I was scared for the most part of that. I really was scared to go back to prison. That's what kept me from drinking. Notice I don't say sober. I say not drinking, because I was still really doing some very questionable things in my life. I focused on building a business is what I did. That became my new alcohol. My checkbook balance, the amount of money that I had and how many guys I had working for me was the new make Charlie feel good. I was still searching for something outside of me to make me feel good. And I built a very successful business. I got married during that time. I stayed married for 5 years. Things were good. And I decided one day that I had arrived and that I knew what was best for me. And I had a relationship with my family and business was good. And I started drinking again. And everything that I had worked so hard for, started to fall to the side. Nothing was as important as my drinking. And it happened, you know, it didn't happen overnight, but it happened pretty quick. You know, I'd been married. As soon as I started drinking again, I didn't even really come home again. I came home to get changes of clothes, and that was it. Drinking was what, you know, I was on the, you know, I had a one-track mind, and that was drinking. That's it. I don't care about you. I don't care about me. I don't care about my mama, any of that. And, you know, my grandmother, I told you guys I'd moved in with her when my father passed, and she was like my number one fan. We had a great relationship. And when she died in 2006, she had a little lady that was coming to her house to help her with oxygen and do some things around the house as she was getting older and couldn't do it. And, you know, I'd call and check on her periodically. She'd never asked me to do things for her, you know, but she'd call me up while she was outside smoking a cigarette and mention that the paint was peeling off the windows or something, you know. So I'd send somebody over to paint her house, and, you know, long story short, that day in 2006, I'd been out in South Dakota pheasant hunting, and I'd met some girls out there, and I flew home with my hunting buddies, and I changed clothes, went home, got some clean clothes, was headed back to the airport. I called my grandmother. She answers the phone. She passes the phone to the lady that takes care of her. I said, hey, what's going on with my grandmother? Let me talk to her. And she says, hang on. And my grandmother says, come see me. And I said, yeah, all right, I'll come see you. You know, hung the phone up, got on the plane, flew to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, drove 2 hours where I was going. As soon as I pulled up to this girl's house, my mother called and said that my grandmother had passed. That's how self-absorbed I was with everything going on in my life. I didn't care. So I want to get to this recovery piece here. And the bottom line for me is that I couldn't quit drinking on my own, period. That's it. Couldn't do it on my own. I got arrested twice for trafficking in 2009, 2010. Thank God it was in Fulton County. And the last time I got arrested, I got pulled over, and I'd been drinking for days. And a police officer walked up to the car. He didn't even talk to me. He jerked the door open. He grabbed me by the arm. We stood up. We stood face to face. Pushed him back. And as soon as I pushed him back, I looked and saw there were like two or three other cars. And I said, you know what? I'm done. I'm tired of living like this. And, I ended up in jail. My mother came to see me. Unfortunately, she found out about what had happened to me on the news. It was embarrassing to my family, to me. And the day of court, my lawyer, who had been a longtime friend of mine, came to see me, and he told me, he said, man, you have a drinking problem. He said, what are you going to do about it? And I didn't know what I was going to do about it, you know. He told me, he said, here's the deal. He said, we'll seal this deal up today. He said, you can go on back to prison. That way you don't have to have any probation. You can just do your time and get out and be a free man. He said, or I can get you some help. I can get you in a treatment center. And I told him I needed a minute to think about it. That's how skewed my thinking was. And I remember walking back into that cell and sitting down, and I probably wasn't there but 2 seconds, and I said, whoa, I need some help. You know. And so I went back in the courtroom, and there sits my mother and my sister, you know, the family members that continue to show up for us, no matter what we've done to them. And, my mother's been crying, her eyes are all red. And the judge asked me, he says, Mr. Wolf, he said, is that your mother? I said, yes, sir. He said, how old are you? I said, I'm 39. He said, don't you think it's time for you to start worrying about your mother instead of her worrying about you? And I was like, man, whew. You know, I was looking for something to crawl up underneath. I really was beginning to realize the pain that I had caused my family. And so, I went back. They called me in the middle of the night. I packed my stuff up. I got ready to leave Rice Street. I'm a Rice Street veteran, man. I can hang in that place. Day one for me in Rice Street, much more comfortable than an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I remember sitting in the tank waiting to go home. And I was waiting to go home, and all these guys kept coming in and leaving and coming in and leaving. And I said, hey, Sarge, what's up? I'm supposed to be going home today. He said, and you are, as soon as your mother gets here to pick you up. And I'm like, man, this is not good. So I was beat. I was beat down. I went to a treatment center up in Sandy Springs, much like some of these other places where you're living with four or five people in an apartment. I wanted to get my license back. I didn't want to go to prison. I had an ankle monitor on. I wanted to kill all those guys that were my roommates. But I was beat down just enough to where I was willing to try something new. And I've said this many times, I didn't think that Alcoholics Anonymous was going to work for me. I didn't think the 12 steps would work for me. There was only one thing that I was 100% sure of, and that was simply that my way of doing things did not work anymore. So that meant I was forced to have my back against the wall. See, I'm the type of person, as long as I got one more card to play, one more move to make, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it. And I'd finally found myself hemmed up where I just didn't have any more moves to make. I got lucky and met some good people early on in recovery. I had a great sponsor that drug me around to meetings, volunteered me to do things I didn't want to do, Most importantly, he started showing me how to act like a man. I didn't know anything about that. See, there's nothing anybody can tell me about drinking. I know how to drink. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I wanted to stop drinking, and I stayed because I needed to figure out how to learn how to live and grow up. Early on, I'll never forget this, and this kid that gave me the service commitment is a friend of my sponsor's. I didn't know that until later. But I had been going to this meeting, and this guy said, hey, I need some help down at the DeKalb County Jail. He said, it's a service commitment. I didn't know what that was. I just thought maybe going by the jail would be a good idea for me to remind myself of where I come from. And he said, I need some help on Saturday mornings. Get with me after the meeting. So, after the meeting, I went, I hunted him down. He said, well, there's a requirement. You have to be sober for 6 months. He said, how long have you been sober? I said, 57 days. He reached up, put his hand on my shoulder. He said, we'll see you Saturday. And so I got up. I took that seriously. I got up every Saturday, and I went to Starbucks, and I went to the DeKalb County Jail. And, I didn't know what was going on. I was just following, putting one foot in front of the other. But it really helped me out. I was raised, not to cry. I was raised that you don't ask another man for help. See, that means I don't have all the answers, So that was the big thing for me to get over in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I had to ask some man that I didn't even know for some help. Thank God I was desperate enough to be willing to do that. I met this guy and he started sponsoring me. And I never asked him to be my sponsor, specifically those words. I'm real manipulative. I like the backdoor way of things. I said, hey, why don't we get together and do some step work, Not having a clue what that was, really. And so we did that for 2 or 3 months, and I learned about him and he learned about me. And I finally got to where I was comfortable and I said, hey, man, if you think you could be my sponsor. And he looked at me just like I was an absolute idiot, He was like, dude, I already am. You're just now figuring this out, I learned a couple things early on, really quickly, in that treatment center. One, I mentioned to you guys that I've never had a positive role model, positive male role model in my life until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I realized straight up, very quickly, that those guys, those cats I was living with in that treatment center, were not the people that I needed to be hanging out with. They weren't the people that I needed to be trying to mold myself after. And there probably wasn't a whole lot that I could learn from them. I needed to go out and I needed to seek out some men that had been living life in recovery. Okay, what does that mean? Good question. That doesn't mean just showing up to meetings, to me. This is my experience. Sobriety is much bigger than that. I think that, the meetings, these meetings are important. Okay, I get it. Sponsorship is important. But to me, what am I doing when nobody's looking? When we talk about carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's easy to do that in here for an hour. We're great liars, manipulators. We're cunning, baffling, and powerful in our own right. The reality is, how do we carry that message outside of here? And for me, the best way that people have asked me, how do I get this thing? What do I do? And my answer is, I don't know how to tell you, man, but I can show you. And I certainly don't have all the answers, but man, between the people that are in this fellowship together, the strength is amazing. My life today is completely different than it was before. My sobriety date, I should have started out with that in the beginning. My sobriety date is February 15th of 2010. My relationship with my family is amazing. Work is going great. Everything that I wanted when I first got sober has been passed by so many times. The relationships that I have with people in Alcoholics Anonymous is what I've been looking for all those years. To be comfortable around other people. To have some people in my life that I could talk about what's really going on with me. I didn't trust people when I first got here. But what I've learned in the short time I've been here is that this thing works, man. If you don't think that people care about you in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you show up and you work on building some relationships, have something, go through something bad in your life and see who shows up. You know, the other side to that is that I'm very extreme in what I do. A lot of times, you know, guys that work for me, I know I'm not the easiest person to deal with. You know, my sister, sometimes I'm just not the easiest person to deal with. I believe in pushing things, you know, to the end of the rope. And that's worked for me in sobriety because I couldn't make sense in my mind, right, that I'm 39 years old and I'm in this treatment center sleeping in this little twin bed and my feet are hanging off the end of it. And I'm sitting around here looking, and these guys are worried about talking to the girl that is in the treatment center in the building next door. And I'm sitting there going, man, that ain't a good idea right now. I got to worry about me. You know, I've got to take care of myself right now. And, you know, so when they say meet people, you know, you got to talk to people. You got to show up to meetings. You got to reach out. You know, some people I went up to and tried to develop relationships with them, and I didn't like them. Or they didn't like me. But I didn't give up. See, when I was drinking, I would have done anything to get a drink, period. So when I decided that I didn't want to drink anymore, I had to become willing to do whatever I had to, you know, to live a life in sobriety. I tell my sponsees that, real simple, if you want to stay sober and find some happiness in Alcoholics Anonymous, get ready to do some things you don't want to do. That's it. It's a very simple program. I, you know, just in closing this thing up, and my relationship with my family is amazing. You know, I don't have any kids. I was just getting it too hard for so many years to take any time to do it. And my sister, you know, I've got a little 2-year-old niece and a, you know, 3-month-old nephew. And those are the only family members I have. You know, my mom and my sister. I don't talk to my dad's family. But my sister was pregnant with my nephew over Christmas, and he was due on the 26th of December. And she called me in the beginning of December, and she said, listen, and Kate is my niece, 2-year-old. She says, listen, she said, the doctor's saying that the baby's going to come on the 26th, and you're the only person that we really feel comfortable leaving Kate with overnight. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? Really? You know, So that's beautiful, you know, that's beautiful. But the other part of it is that this alcoholic brain on the way over there at 1 o'clock in the morning is thinking, man, these people are crazy. I mean, that's how I think left alone. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about sponsorship because I told you guys that that's been the first time in my life where I've had some positive role models. I can't speak for anybody but myself, but I have a very skewed view of myself at any given time. And I absolutely, you know, to get where I'm at today and to continue to grow and move forward in sobriety and to keep from drinking, I got to have some guys in my life. I got to have some men in my life that can kind of reset my view of things. I'm learning a little bit as we go. You know, things have not always been great in recovery. I had a sponsee a year and a half ago, and he just celebrated again. But he was getting ready to get married. He was engaged to this girl, and they've got a 2-year-old daughter. And they went out to watch a softball game on a Friday night, and they came home, and she hung herself in the bathroom. Just got up, walked out of the den, no prior signs of anything, not an alcoholic that I know of, it's not my business. And she lived, but she's severely brain damaged. And the reason that I share that story with you is that he called 911, and then he called me, and I called my sponsor, and by the time they got to the hospital, there were probably at least 3 or 4 people up there from Alcoholics Anonymous to support him. You know, the other piece of that, too, is that, you know, if you're new, think about that when you decide to go drink, you know? If you feel like you need to go get you one more, think about that. Because there's really no excuse for that. If we're all in here tonight, then we've been given a choice. And I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is a gift. But we have to do some work if we want to stay here. We have to do some continued work. You know, one of my favorite pieces in that big book is on 181, Dr. Bob's story. He's talking about how he spends a great deal of time working with other men. And he does it for four reasons. This may not be exactly, but I know the gist of it. One is a sense of duty. Two, it's a pleasure. Three, in doing so, he's passing on what was freely given to him by the other man. And four, all important four, every time we do that, we're taking out some insurance against another slip. You know, we're taking insurance out for ourselves from another slip. And I believe that if you're an Alcoholics Anonymous and you're just coming to meetings, you're missing out. You're selling yourself short. The magic in this thing began to happen for me in working with other guys. Some of them still sober. Some of them not sober. Some of them in prison. And some of them dead. But I'm sober today. I believe that, I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. This program works. There's no doubt about it. You know, the question is, how bad do you want it? What are you willing to do? And, I'm getting better at just continuing to try to learn a little something from some of these guys that have been around in here. That's what I look to some of these men that we call old-timers and ladies, too. But for me, it's men because I don't really, you know, I don't really mess with women in here anymore for the past 7 months. And the reason that, and that, you know, that's another gift of this program, too. And I say that and people that know me are laughing about that. But I'm 43 years old. This is the first time that I've ever been in a monogamous relationship with one woman for over 6 months. So that's a blessing. You know, it really is. But these guys, you know, that have been around here for a while, the old timers, as we call them, watch what they're doing. You know, it's so easy to come in here and put on a big show. You know, what are you doing outside of here? And I can't tell you how grateful I am for those guys, for this program, for the life that's been given to me. You know, I was on Facebook earlier today, and I was just thinking back about things in the past. And there's from my high school, there's like a memorial page for all the people that have passed. You know, and I started scrolling through it and looking at these names, and I'm like thinking, man, how have I been given this gift? And all of these other people, like, they didn't even really do anything wrong. You know, they seem like such great, nice people. You know, and they're gone. You know, and I started thinking, why me? You know? But I like to take that a step further and say, why not me? You know? Why not me? So if I've been given this gift, then that means I got to step up and I got to pass it on. You know, I've tried to be as eloquent as I can tonight, Alonzo. But this deal of Alcoholics Anonymous is a no excuses. I don't believe in excuses. I didn't make excuses when I was drinking, and I cannot make them today, because I will find myself in some serious trouble very quickly with this head. I'll leave you guys with this in closing. I got to that treatment center, right? Scared to death. I was complaining. I almost threw this one kid that worked out of Waffle House out the third story window because he was up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I was really sick, very sick and irritable. And I went into my counselor's office and I was complaining to her about everything. You know, I don't like my roommate and we need to turn the air conditioner up and I don't want to go to this meeting. You know, I'm great at coming up with excuses. And she told me that if I wanted something I'd never had, I had to become willing to do something that I'd never done. And I, I'm I'm glad that I stuck around long enough, because I remember coming to these meetings not knowing where I was going, and I just kept coming. I kept showing up, kept watching. I didn't drink. So thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Good job, Charlie. Thank you.
If the river keep rising, water gonna overflow. If that river keep rising, flood water gonna overflow. Just like that old river, baby, it's my time to go. Thank God.